This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold Golden and Gregory.
Welcome to Energy Matters, a show about how you can save money on your utility bills, use technology wisely, and live a more sustainable lifestyle. Here's your host, veteran energy regulator and clean energy expert, Commissioner Tim Echols.
Thank you, Scott Slade, and welcome to Energy Matters. We want to help you save money to use technology and to live a more sustainable lifestyle. In the studio with me, as always, my co-host, former State Representative John Noel, Casey Boyce here today, and James Marlowe, the founder of Radiant Solar. We're going to be talking in this episode about the future of solar in the U.S. and in Georgia. And James, I have to say that Germany and California certainly have paid the learning curve for solar. And we're benefiting from that. You've been to Germany. All of us have been to Germany and looked at that. What have we learned from them, and where are they going in the future?
Well, there's innovation coming from all over the world. California is still 50% of the U.S. solar market, and California really is a different country. It's you know, fourth or fifth largest economy in the world. And they're embracing technology in ways that other places typically follow, because they prove the economics, they show it can work. So California has recently, with the support of home builders and real estate people, enacted 100% requirement for new home construction to include solar. They're moving to 100% renewable energy standard for the state, as New York did this week. So we see innovation that's come from New Jersey. We've seen innovation in North Carolina, here in the Southeast. So there's just an awful lot going on in this area that's giving our utilities more tools to work with. It's giving homeowners and business owners more options in the way that they choose to source their energy and to find savings and reduced environmental impact in doing so.
I've heard some grumbling about that big government coming in and trying to tell me how to build a house and trying to tell me I have to put solar on my house in California. All right, fair point. But is it not true that doing this from new construction, from the new construction point of view, drops the cost tremendously because you have efficiencies of scale? And tell us about how much a typical cost. You had to retrofit it on my house. How much does it cost to put in a new place?
Well, when you're putting it in new home construction, you're typically doing it in a very systematized process. So you've got economies of scale and labor savings. You're buying the equipment in volume. You're typically building it in a community scale. So the reason it saw such strong support in California is that it was just a benefit to the homeowners. It was a benefit to people selling homes. It was a benefit to people building homes. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't an expensive option that was a drag on the housing industry. It was something that was going to make it better.
And if you end up doing it up front, then you don't have to go back and rip out walls and run wires and things like that. When we did our house back in 2008, we renovated. We put in wiring for solar and an EV charger, knowing they'd be, you know, happening down the road. Wow. And boy, I'm glad we did that, because that saved us thousands of dollars and lots of disruption.
Interesting. We call that making a building or a home solar ready. So a little bit like in the old day when you'd pre-wire speaker wires when you were building a house or whatever, but it's an intelligent thing to do.
The only example in Georgia of stuff ready, solar or EV ready, is in Atlanta now. They just passed an ordinance requiring all new residential construction, and it may dive down into other areas, that be EV ready. That is, that they have electrical connections to the garage where the cars would park and required to be heavier duty electrical.
And that's a very low-cost thing. So you're running wire and conduit before you pour concrete. So you're doing something that has very minimal cost that, as you said, can save you thousands of dollars later on.
So let's get back to Germany and California. And in Germany in specific, there was a really cool project that I read about recently where there's a battery company that has a lot of homeowners with their system in Germany, and they're enabling what they call a virtual power plant. So homeowners kind of pool their battery together and they use it to offset demand at various points during the day. Is that something that you see coming to the U.S. at any time soon, or Georgia more specifically?
I think it will. The benefits of a battery is that you can firm power, you can use reliability or off-grid capabilities, you can use energy at different times so that it's more affordable and it benefits the utility. So I think utilities will begin to see that this is a benefit to their systems and a way for them to save money as well. So there are many grid benefits to doing things like that that benefit the business, the home, or the utility.
So what's the barrier? What's stopping that from happening right now?
Well, some of it is regulatory. You have utilities that are focused on low cost and reliable and safe systems. And, you know, they're beginning to learn to incorporate new technologies, but they often want to do a little bit slower than entrepreneurs or business people like myself would like to see them do it.
That things need to be moving a lot faster. What would you see? What would you like? Speaking of speed, what would you like to see? If you had a magic wand, what would you change today in Georgia in solar?
We're going through an integrated resource plan at the Public Service Commission. So I'd like to see us continue to do what we've been doing, which has been great policy by the Public Service Commission with leadership like Tim and Bubba McDonald and the work they've done, like Georgia Power and their efforts and Green Power and Jeff Pratt and Oglethorpe. Those folks have done a great job. There's been no upward pressure on the rates. So we've done solar.
There's been no upward pressure.
Pressure on the rate base.
Yeah.
And then we've also enabled a lot more solar. So let's continue doing what we've been doing.
Right.
Let's incorporate more distributed generation so that we do like 10% more, so that maybe 80-20 would be my recommendation, 80% large scale and 20% distributed generation. We need to continue to make our programs simpler and much more of a standing program so that you, if you're a business and you're planning, you can plan easier and you can take the time needed to safely add these systems to your facilities. We'd like to see the community solar program that Georgia Power has become a more robust and more widely adopted program.
Cheaper?
We'd like to see a continuation of making large companies like Facebook came to Georgia and they said, we want to invest billions in Georgia and we want solar, and they're going to do 400 megawatts of solar, which is about $400 million worth of solar.
Wow.
So, you know, those are opportunities to bring investment to the state. It's a very pro-business position and one that's good for our utilities and good for jobs and economic development.
Well, what about tariffs? I mean, is this hurting you or is it not?
Well, in solar, the tariffs have definitely been a headwind, and there's really kind of two pieces to it. One is there was a period of uncertainty, and the uncertainty was actually worse than the tariff itself. So you had many people that were doing business planning, and they said, we're going to wait and see what this tariff does to our business. So once the tariff was announced, solar panel prices started moving back down as they've done. Once again, solar has dropped about 80% in the last 8 years. So a lot like flat panel televisions, which seem to be in every room I go in now.
Oh, boy.
They're low cost and they're everywhere, and there's one right above my head here in the studio. So solar panels are following that same cost compression and that same, you know, kind of mainstream adoption that we've seen with personal computers or cell phones or flat panel televisions.
Well, it strikes me that that cost piece is so important, because in our research we see, you know, consumers across the country have been getting this message that you're just sharing with us now, right? That you know, the price of solar is coming down, it's a lot cheaper, and then a utility offering comes out and it's, you know, pay extra for solar, and the customer's sitting there scratching their head saying, wait a minute, I've been hearing that this is cheaper and you're asking me to pay more. So I think that what we've talked about here is really important, right, in terms of the adoption, making sure that there's that downward pressure on rates, and that, you know, if there is a specific solar offering, that customers see that benefit coming through to them, right?
Is it not true that solar is the cheapest form of energy in the United States now? I mean, you've got solar, wind, coal, natural gas. I mean, it's sort of, it goes up from there, and then we get to other radioactive sources. But I mean, the point is, we've got multiple layers of costs. And that's what I love about solar, is it's cheap, cheap, cheap.
So on a cost per kilowatt basis, solar is the cheapest form of generation that we have. And it is the fastest growing form of new generation. So as systems add solar, now, you know, you need to do good integrated resource planning, because solar is a peaking resource. The sun doesn't shine at night. So you have to balance base load
batteries,
and peaking
batteries,
need.
Though?
And then incorporate batteries more intelligently. So in the integrated resource plan, I would like to see more battery storage pilots of all sizes. So not just one or two little small ones, but let's do some large scale, let's do some medium scale, let's do some on these military bases so that we continue to strengthen the DOD capabilities in our state, which are really important. And we make it available, you know, to other companies that are coming in, like data centers and others.
So, James, I'm going to ask you a really practical question that I don't think we've talked about on the show, which is, how long do these solar panel systems last, and what do you do with them when they're no longer working?
So solar panels are a really unique product because they come with a 25-year production warranty. And they're designed to be in the environment. They last a long time. They don't have any moving parts. It's glass. It's an aluminum frame in some cases. Some cases they don't even have a frame. They have silicon in most cases, or cadmium telluride in other cases. And those products can be easily recycled. There's not a lot of recycling going on right now because they haven't come to end of life. So there's not a lot of volume in recycling. So therefore, the supply chain has not yet developed.
Well, that's good to know.
But the materials that are in there have a value, a salvage value that can be extracted. And as we have that opportunity, the recyclers are sitting there ready to build that industry.
Interesting. Okay, I like it. I love it. What's the biggest question you get about solar?
I think the biggest question is around cost and economics. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you have people that will say,
that used to be hard. Now
it's
easy.
We looked at solar 3 years ago and it was too expensive. And it's like,
right.
Well, you know, let's revisit that. Let's look at the real numbers today and look at the economics and the cost of solar panels that are in the market right now.
Right. And are you what mix of solar and batteries are you seeing, both residential and commercial customers?
Well, our focus is utility and industrial, so there's not a lot of batteries and storage being used. In the solarized residential programs, I'm told that the number's about 40-45% of the homes will have battery storage.
That's a lot.
Wow, great information. When we come back, James, I want to talk about this UGA project that you guys did on Millage Avenue that folks can see if they go out and, you know, watch a soccer game or go out to the livestock arena or to see football practice out there. I'm Tim Eccles. You're listening to Energy Matters, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Energy Matters would like to thank Gas South for its support of the show. Gas South has a no-deposit policy and offers some of the lowest per-therm rates in the state. Use the promo code MATTERS for a special deal. Gas South, the difference is good.
Gas South believes in the difference we can all make, like the difference in putting people first and showing that you care. For us, our difference is saving people money with our best rates and no deposit. And the difference we make in our community by taking care of our friends and neighbors and giving back 5% of our profits to help children in need. Learn more about what makes us different at GasSouth.com. Gas South. The difference is good.
Logan Booker, producer of Energy Matters, here for Green Power EMC. From the suburbs to rural farming communities, Georgia is enjoying the benefits of a more sustainable future through the power of solar energy. Available from 38 of Georgia's member-owned electric membership cooperatives, or EMCs, these not-for-profit utilities are harnessing the sun's energy to bring clean, renewable, and affordable electricity to 4.2 million Georgians. For more information, visit www.greenpoweremc.com or contact your local EMC.
Welcome back to Energy Matters. Well, this has been an interesting topic with some great people. First, let's thank our sponsors. Support for Energy Matters comes from Arnold, Golden, and Gregory. AGG takes a business sensibility approach when advising clients. AGG provides industry knowledge, attention to detail, transparency, and value to help businesses and individuals achieve their definition of success. AGG's transaction, litigation, regulatory, privacy counselors serve clients in healthcare, real estate, litigation, business transactions, fintech, global commerce, government investigations, logistics, and transportation. AGG subscribes to the belief, not if, but how. We appreciate their weekly support of Energy Matters, where we're helping you save money, we're helping you use technology, and we're helping you be more sustainable. We have got one of the sustainability gurus here in the form of James Marlowe, founder of Radiant Solar, and my friend Casey Boyce is joining Commissioner Tim Eccles here to talk really more about solar in Georgia. Casey?
Yeah, so before the break, Tim was talking about this project that UGA's done on Millage Avenue, and I don't know about this project, James. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I'd be happy to. It's one of the favorite projects that I've worked on. We had the pleasure of working with Georgia Power on a research and development project that they conducted with the Electric Power Research Institute and the University of Georgia. It's on Millage Avenue, and it is about 11 acres of land, and it has about seven different types of solar all on one site so that they can compare and contrast.
Seven different types.
Different types of technologies.
What kind of types of solar are there?
So they have a dual-axis tracker, which will track on both axes so that it will capture more sunlight and follow the sun. They have single-axis trackers, which are a little bit like level or blinds. They'll roll with the sun and produce about 20% more energy. There are fixed arrays at different orientations so that you can capture more sunlight in the summertime versus the wintertime, where it's more productive.
Yeah.
They have a battery backup test there, and they also have special inverter. The inverter transfers DC power into AC power, and they can control those remotely and do some things to test smart inverters. So it's a really exciting project, and it's really, really pretty cool to see if you're at the soccer field there.
That's really cool. So what kinds of things is UGA learning from this array, or Georgia Power, or you? Like, what are you getting out of it?
Well, I think they're able to learn the benefits of different orientations, so how you site solar. They're looking at, you know, some of the vegetation. The Turf Management School is looking at. So there are a number of things that the school's able to do, and it's also got an educational component.
Very cool.
I bet students just eat this stuff up. I mean, who do you find? Your employees, for example. You're a huge job creator here in Georgia. All these solar companies are. It's fastest growing. Isn't it right that solar is one of the fastest growing
occupations? We have around 4,300 employees now, so it's been a high growth area, and we get people from Tech and Emory and UGA and other
schools.
I love
your story. Seven people to 4,300 people since 2008 or whenever it was. So you're finding people right out of school. Are you seeing, and I'm in the world of energy efficiency, college students want to talk to me about this. They're attracted to it because it's environmentally friendly, it's innovative, they're interested in my space. Are you finding the same thing? And when you're doing new hires, who are those people?
Well, we hire all types of people, and most of them do believe in sustainability, and they believe that what we do has a societal benefit, that we help people save money and reduce cost, but we also have a reduced environmental impact, and that we impact air quality and water quality. So people from construction fields come to us. People that are recent college grads come to us that might want to work in design. They may want to work in marketing or sales. So, you know, we need all disciplines, in this industry.
So if I'm going to school right now and I'm picking a major and I want to work in the solar field, what should I major in? What do I need
well,
to study?
Well, I think technical backgrounds are always really helpful.
Not a history degree.
So that,
sorry, John.
The history degree is a good degree as well, because we want creative thinkers that might want to work in marketing, or they might want to work in a customer-facing side of the business. So we have a real mix of talented people in our company and in the industry.
That's a good point. Because you got to sell this stuff. I mean, you got to have salespeople. You've got to have installers, and not just installers. And you got to have engineers to engineer that. I've been to your office. I've seen some of these desks as big as this control room, where people are laying out plans, and you're looking at what it looks like on top of an industrial building, and what all the interconnections are, and all the panels, and how they're going to be put down there. I mean, that's not easy, and that takes Georgia Tech grads. That takes
it's electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, structural engineering, geotechnical work, so that we know what's in the soils, and then you have solar specialties, looking at what would the performance of a solar array be if you used a different type of equipment or had a different orientation.
So on that note, what's been the most difficult solar project that you've been involved in, and why?
Well, we've done about 350, and I always say we haven't had an easy one yet. You know, that they all have a challenge of some sort. You just sometimes don't know what that challenge will be.
The ones he lost money on, those are the ones he's going to be like, oh, they stunk.
I don't know. I think we've learned a lot in that decade of experience, and that we continue to learn, and we continue to use new equipment. I mean, we're constantly using new technologies, new approaches. I'm going to leave here today and go to a project here in Athens-Clarke County at their water treatment facility, and we're working with some guys from MIT on a new racking system that uses pneumatics. So there's always something to learn. There's always something to try to improve these technologies.
So you mentioned earlier that solar has an impact on water quality, and you're headed over to this project with Athens-Clarke County. What's the impact of solar on water, or water on solar? Like what?
Well, the water energy nexus is to me a fascinating topic. But our lights here in Georgia, if you're on Georgia Power, they use about 1.6 gallons of water for every kilowatt generated. And
wow.
Most people don't really make that connection. But if you're using thermoelectric. So if you're using coal or natural gas,
you use water
for cooling. If you're using a nuclear plant, so that water and the connection to energy is really vital. And that, you know, we're now a state of 12 plus million people, and we're going to be a state of 15 million people. So water is important for energy. It's important for agriculture. It's important for our cities. So water and energy are very, very interrelated. So at wastewater treatment plants, they obviously use a lot of energy to treat water, then to recondition it. So pumping of water. So there's even some people that believe about 50% of our energy is used in water-related tasks.
That's
so
incredible.
Gracious, treating. That is incredible. Yeah, pumping the water up and down. I mean, you got to get it, then you got to filter it, then you got to get it to the house, then you got to deal with the waste and pump all that stuff up and down. And holy mackerel. Yeah, I wouldn't do all that.
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that we haven't really touched on the show, have we? I mean, I don't think most people realize that there's this, as you said, energy-water nexus, right? That, you know, solar power helps preserve water for other uses and helps reduce the amount of electricity that's used for, you know, cleaning and transporting drinking water.
So what do you think the future of solar is in the United States and in Georgia?
Well, the only thing I'm absolutely certain of is that there's going to be a lot more solar. And that, you know, the rate of adoption will vary. One of the most interesting things Georgia Power is using in some of their presentations is a graph of the energy mix that shows in the next 3 years that 13% of our energy will come from solar, and that's an equal percentage to nuclear.
And over what period?
So that will be, once again, in the next 3 years when they complete many of the projects that are still under development. But
we'll be up to 13%.
Up from zero. That's up from zero when we started 11 years ago. So there's been a very strong uptake of solar in Georgia because the economics are driving it. You know, we've got a good rational economic model that is having our utilities use a lot more solar because it is more cost effective for them to do so.
And it is the role of TIMS Public Service Commission to come in and say, this is the mix we want. We want more solar. We want nuclear, in his case. We want less coal. We want more natural gas. Whatever that mix is, that's his responsibility and the Public Service Commission's responsibility. And your advocacy is for more solar because it's green, because you're a free market capitalist, you'd like to make a little money, and because you see it as a low-cost alternative to all the other stuff.
It just makes economic sense.
Yeah, and the Public Service Commission, as we look at things, I mean, reliability is very important to us. I mean, clearly, with a state mostly run by Republicans, you know, at this point, we still
exclusively run by.
Yeah, we still want to keep economic development and jobs at the forefront. It's very, very important to us, and as long as the Republicans are running the state, I think that's going to continue to be the driving force. So it's not that I am, you know, adamant for nuclear power. I mean, yes, it's important. I see nuclear energy and renewables really going together, moving us towards, you know, a carbon-free future. And I don't think that we can get there, John, without nuclear energy. We can't.
I see the little girl walking down in the daisy field and the little mushroom cloud behind. I mean, that's I see a whole different walking through the forest of flowers.
Yeah, but there just hasn't been that mushroom cloud here in the United States. You can't show me a mushroom cloud.
Won't see a mushroom cloud. You do have to go to Russia to see the mushroom cloud.
Yeah, there was a mushroom cloud.
Or the Pacific Ocean
there.
To see the radioactive
cloud. And you know what? To be fair, we can't afford a catastrophic accident anywhere in the world every 15 years. That's not going to help the nuclear energy.
But one thing we know
business.
Is that his solar farm he's building in South Georgia won't have an accident. We never hear the sun came up and it's been a terrible spill of solar radioactive
spill is a great day.
Solar spill is a great day, not a bad day of coal ash or whatever else. So I think what we can agree to is that solar energy is clean, it is green, and it is low cost. And I'm so grateful for James Marlowe and people like him that got in the solar business and doing this. And frankly, I'm grateful for people like Commissioner Eccles who've advocated, as much as I want to wring his neck sometimes on other issues, he's advocating for solar, he's doing a lot of the right things, and I look forward to arguing with him on other stuff, though.
You know, and I think we end this segment talking about exactly what we began the segment with, and that is that you don't have to completely agree with a person in order to make progress. And I mean, this radio show, the way we do this show, is case in point. That we try to feature the best of ideas. We try to bring the brain trust of sustainability to the microphone, and we will continue to do that. James, thank you for being here. Keep up the great work. Tim Eccles of Energy Matters here for Solar Sun World. No doubt you've seen solar panels popping up all over the state. If you want the precision of German engineering when it comes to solar, Solar Sun World is for you. Gerd and all the folks at Solar Sun World understand the complexities of solar and how to make it work for you. From tax credits to inverters to accelerated depreciation, they'll advise you on the best path forward. And Solar Sun World now offers power purchase agreements. Find them at solarsunworld.com, solarsunworld.com.
Tim Eccles from Marlin Gas Services. As the port continues to grow, more and more trucking companies are using natural gas in their trucks instead of diesel. Marlin Gas Services is helping to usher in this clean opportunity. With their specialized rigs, they create virtual pipelines with all the equipment and expertise to provide reliable, clean natural gas. Marlin Gas is the company that gas utilities, pipeline companies, and industrial facilities turn to. See marlingas.com for more information.
This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by BMW Auto Sales.
With gas prices hitting over $3 for the first time since 2014, isn't it time you consider a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid from BMW Auto Sales? These plug-in hybrids will go 50 miles on electric charge, saving you precious money and time. Skip the line at the gas pumps and charge in your garage. See more at ev-hybrid.com. That's ev-hybrid.com.
Hey, welcome back to Energy Matters. Your host, Tim Eccles, here with my co-host, Casey Boyce in Decatur. Casey, how's it going?
Hey, it's great to be with you this morning.
Hey, Casey, we've got Meredith Angwin from Wilder, Vermont, and it's great to welcome her to the show, University of Chicago grad, author of Shorting the Grid. Meredith, how's it going up there?
Oh, it's going great. Thank you so much. It's a beautiful spring day.
Yeah, Meredith, you are from Cornwall, UK, and that's what, southwest England down there? Where tell us about Cornwall a little bit.
Well, I'm not from Cornwall, but my husband's family is, and we visited there, and it's southwest England near Land's End, and it's basically historically been a mining area, and the miners from Cornwall were the premier hard rock miners as opposed to coal miners, and they dispersed all over. That you can find them in California for gold mining, you can find them in South Africa for gold mining, you can find them in South America for tin mining, because they were very knowledgeable hard rock miners, and his father was.
Casey, I've been to the UK, southern UK, only once, and I was down with Allie Kelly and Harriet and Alan, one of their board members, and we were looking at this solar field that had pollinator flowers because Allie and them wanted to do this on the Ray. So we were met by this guy named Harry. He picked us up in a Range Rover and he took us to a little pub. And as we're driving along, Harry starts talking about, we were talking about Facebook and some problems that he got in trouble with his family about Facebook. And so we're riding along and go, well, what happened with your family? Well, he said, well, it's the royal family. My wife's mother, you know, is married to Prince Charles. And I had posted some things on Facebook and I kind of got in trouble. And the palace kind of took down my Facebook page. And so we're sitting there. Oh, my goodness. Here we are with the royal family. And we wind up going, you know, to his solar field. He gives us some royal honey that came out of Prince Charles' honeycombs. I had to buy a special luggage just to take the thing back. So anyway, Meredith, that's my experience in the southern UK. How is that for my first time?
Well, it's not typical. I would say it's not typical at all. I mean, my husband's family were miners, and you know, the tin mines and copper mines there ultimately played out and were outcompeted by newer tin mines all over the world. And there was a great exodus from Cornwall around 1900. And but I mean, that's but the royal family. That's an unusual situation.
Hey, that BBC series Poldark, that was about southern mining in Cornwall, right? Wasn't that tin mining?
Yes, it was. It definitely was.
Yeah, if you haven't watched the Poldark series, my wife and I love BBC television, and so we watch all those masterpiece theaters that come out. Casey, you a big masterpiece fan?
No, not at all.
No. Casey, how about you, Meredith? Do you like Masterpiece Theater on public television?
Well, I don't really watch that much. I read a lot. I mean, it's really bad, but I just read all the time. I've always been
that way. I think you're alone on this one.
Yeah, that's probably why you two guys are so smart, and I'm over here sitting watching television. So, okay, now we know what my problem is, too much TV. Well, Meredith, Meredith, we're having you on today because of this Texas thing that happened. And I know you've thought a lot about that, talked a lot about that. Your book addresses some things about that. So as you look back at this Texas situation this winter, what's kind of your spin and your take on what happened out there?
Well, my feeling is that the organization of the Texas grid into what's called an RTO, Regional Transmission Organization system, is the fundamental problem. And the reason is that there's a competition on payments, on energy payments, and you can't invest in reliability because you're trying to get the absolutely cheapest power because of the auctions. And the auctions are very odd. People have to understand that they're not a market quite the way we think of markets. For example, if you wanted to buy some zucchinis in a farmer's market and I offered you some at 10 cents and someone offered you some at 20 cents and you decided to take both sets of zucchinis, if this was an auction in the electricity system, you'd have to pay us both 20 cents because that would be the clearing price. So what happens is that the generators actually love it when there's a crisis on the grid because that's when the clearing price soars and they all get that price. It's a very perverse incentive. Because if you kept, let's say in New England, we have a problem in the winter that the natural gas pipelines can't carry enough gas for homes and power plants. Well, this is an easy cure. All you have to do is keep some diesel on site for the dual-fueled power plants. But they won't keep the diesel on site because, first of all, then they'd have to pay for the diesel and they may or may not get reimbursed for it. And secondly, if everybody kept diesel on site, the highest clearing prices would be low. And then what would you do there? You want those high clearing prices because most power plants on an RTO grid actually don't make money. They basically all the time they're losing money, and there are articles about it you can find.
Yeah, Casey, what do you think?
Well, so I'm curious, Meredith, because, you know, for our listeners, there are a number of these RTOs, regional transmission organizations around the U.S. and a number of different market designs. And, you know, the thing that's unique about Texas is that it's an energy only market, right? That the generators are paid just for the energy that they deliver to the grid. And I'm curious, Meredith, as you look at that market design versus something like PJM, which is a market in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland, hence the name. claims that has other components to it, where, for example, they pay for capacity and other grid services. Do the differences in market design matter for this kind of thing?
Well, they want to say that they'll matter, but I don't think they do. And what I, at the beginning of the book I have, I give an example of a winter situation in New England, where we have a capacity market. People were being paid for capacity, and yet the system operator was doing everything in its power to get the plants to live up to their capacity obligations, because they set up a pay per performance where they fined plants if they didn't live up to their capacity obligations. But why did they have to even do that? If a capacity market would do it, then all you need is a capacity market. But it turns out that what happens is you have to layer more and more fixes on top of the capacity market to get the plants to live up to their obligations, because they're just merchant generators and they don't want to run when they're losing money.
That makes sense. And, you know, most of our listeners are in Georgia. And of course, here in Georgia, we've got a very different kind of structure, right, Tim?
Yeah, we do. I mean, folks come to me all the time wanting us to deregulate our energy market. Meredith, the way you describe it, it's a nightmare.
Well, it is pretty much of a nightmare. First of all, when it's deregulated, it is still got lots of regulators. Pretty famous article by Travis Kavula said that, that can energy ever be deregulated, and that the rules for the deregulated markets were three times as long as the rules for the regulated markets. In other words, the deregulated markets encounter all sorts of problems, like I say, that could be solved easily, but aren't being solved because there's no incentive to solve them. And so I don't think that deregulation becomes fragile markets, more expensive markets. All kinds of studies show that the deregulated markets, the quote deregulated markets, are more expensive than to the end user.
Meredith, let me ask you, do you think those Texas energy providers had an incentive to winterize their plants and do preventive maintenance? I mean, is that built into their system?
No, none at all. None at all. They had no such incentive, because after all, they'd have to spend the money, and then that would make their bids higher. They might not have called on as much. Or if the clearing price was low because there's wind on the grid, it wouldn't help them to have spent the money winterizing their system. The absolutely most reasonable thing for a Texas operator to do would be drop out if it's really bad weather, rather than winterize. Why spend the money when you get it back maybe once every 10 years?
When we come back, we're going to bring our guest back, Meredith Angwin from Wilder, Vermont, who has roots in Cornwall, UK, and talk about more issues with deregulation, why the Georgia system is superior, why our rates are lower, why our commissioners are cooler. So stick around. We're going to have some fun on Energy Matters. I love you, Meredith. You're singing my song. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Everyone has tough times in their life. By checking the Project Share box at the bottom of your utility bill, you can make life a little easier for your neighbors. Your $1, $2, or $5 checkoff is matched by the utility and then used by the Salvation Army to help folks having a tough time paying their energy bills. It's that easy. Join PSC Commissioner Tim Echols and many others by donating via your power bills this year. See more by clicking ProjectShareInfo.com. And thank you.
Hey, this is Tim Eccles. We talk all the time on Energy Matters about buying a used EV instead of a new one. Let someone else pay the depreciation. BMVW Auto Sales, one of our show sponsors, can fix you up. Go to their website at ev-hybrid.com to see the ever-changing inventory. BMVW has every brand, every type of EV, and they'll even let you test drive it for 3 days, show you how to charge it and drive it for maximum performance. That's ev-hybrid.com. EV-hybrid.com.
This segment of Energy Matters is sponsored by Hall Booth Smith. This law firm works with over 88 Fortune 500 companies, and they have offices from Brunswick to Athens, Tifton to Columbus, and of course Atlanta. We'd like to thank Hall Booth Smith for the great work they do with school boards, hospitals, cities, and counties all over our state. See more at hallboothsmith.com.
Welcome back to Energy Matters. I'm Casey Boyce here with Tim Eccles and our guest today, Meredith Angwin, author of Shorting the Grid. And just before we went to break, Tim was doing a little bit of log rolling about how cool Georgia's energy market design is and how cool the Georgia Public Service Commissioners are. And listeners, I suppose you guys can judge for yourself, but we'd like to talk with Meredith a little bit more about what she's seen in her book and maybe get a little bit more nuanced about market design and what she thinks the best way forward is. Of course, we've been talking about Texas and the winter storm there, and you know, we've spoken about it on the show before. Meredith, as you look at, you know, kind of your experience in the Northeast and looking at Texas, what would have been the solution? I mean, if you were, you know, Governor Greg Abbott or you know, on the Texas Public Utilities Commission, what would you do to help prevent this kind of thing in the future?
Well, I don't know how much power the governor has about it. Once you set up an RTO system, it's very robust against changes, except for changes made by the participants committee. And the participants committee is basically the people who have a stake in the grid. That is, they own power plants or they own transmission lines, and they get to file rule changes with FERC. Oh well, I guess Texas maybe doesn't do quite as much of that, but
they don't. That's the reason they're their own grid, is that they avoid any sort of jurisdiction from the Federal Energy Regulatory Committee or FERC.
Well, they can't avoid it all because there are NERC rules of how you run a substation that everybody has to follow. But basically, yes, they don't have as many orders and so forth going on as one of the other grids does.
Meredith, I was on a NARUC call on Friday. This committee that we have is actually a DOE organized committee on nuclear energy. And one of the things that we were talking about, and I know you guys had Vermont Yankee up there and you closed it, but one of the things we were talking about was that natural gas, even though it's a cheap fuel, because Texas didn't have firm natural gas, they didn't get their natural gas. And we saw that in the polar vortex as well in 2014. But I mean, as you think about what happened in Texas, the issues without firm gas, the winterization problem, I mean, do you see nuclear energy as part of the solution here for states going forward?
Well, absolutely. But then again, I've been a booster of nuclear for years. And back when I was much younger and I was a project manager at the Electric Power Research Institute, I was a project manager in renewables, and I switched over to being a project manager in nuclear, which is kind of was very odd at that time. But and nowadays, it's more common to understand that these are all non-polluting sources. I wanted to also say something about Texas and natural gas and so forth and so on. Basically, I feel the grids can get into trouble by having too many renewables backed up by natural gas, because renewables go on and off when they want to, and natural gas is just-in-time delivery. So you actually want to have a grid that has some energy stored on site. That is, it could my favorite is nuclear, but you know, coal, oil, they store it on site, so it doesn't have to be delivered in and it's in New England. My gosh, getting things delivered in bad weather, I mean, it was It was dramatic. I mean, bridges that were raised to let fuel ships through, even though it was rush hour, so it blocked traffic, all that sort of stuff. It's dramatic, but dramatic isn't what you want on a grid. Reliable is what you want.
I think I love you.
Whoa, wait a second. Would you say that one more time, Meredith? Would you say that one more time? Just starting with dramatic. Go ahead.
Dramatic is not what you want on a grid. Reliable is what you want. You want a boring grid.
I think I love you.
Oh, my goodness. Casey, why have we not had Meredith testify at the Georgia Public Service Commission? Why is she not on the campaign trail with me traveling around the state of Georgia touting reliability? Meredith, you are the voice that we need in our state. Casey, what do you think?
So I'm going to push back just a little bit. So I will say reliability absolutely is critical, right? I mean, we saw this in Texas. We all know this intuitively. When the power goes down, it's at best, it's an inconvenience. At worst, it's life-threatening, right? So you've got no qualms for me in terms of reliability. That being said, I think we should push the grid operators to make things just a little bit more interesting behind the scene, because we do have to integrate more renewables. We do have to look for lower carbon solutions, and that's going to require a lot more flexibility on their ends. And whether it's natural gas backup, and Meredith, I think you make a great critique of it, whether it's battery backup, whether it's demand side flexibility, I think they need to make it a little bit more like, we need a movie about grid operators. That's what we need, like a Steven Spielberg movie about grid operators.
What do you think, Meredith? Rated G? just rated G for boring? I mean, that's all we need is the boring grid, right?
Yeah, well, I would say that in general, if people come and visit a balancing authority, that is the big control room where they say the demand on the grid is going up and therefore that plant is now online, it is dramatic because it's the biggest machine on earth. Everything has to be in balance all the time, so it isn't really boring. But what I mean is that there's a different level of boring when the frequency is going down on the grid and plants are going to be tripping offline to protect themselves. And then compressors are failing because they can't get electricity, which means that they can't pump gas, which means that even more power plants are going offline. Basically, there are cures for these things. For example, you can have a regulation that power plants have to make firm arrangements for natural gas. I mean, you just make that regulation. The trouble is, in an RTO system that goes in many states, they're not allowed to make any regulation that favors one type of fuel over another, even though different fuels have very different characteristics. Natural gas is delivered just in time, but they can't make a regulation that thou shalt have, firm contracts, because that would be interfering with how the merchant generators want to run things. And as a matter of fact, we had our system operator had purchased oil to be kept at dual fire generators, and FERC said that was great and it saved your grid during a very bad cold snap. You have to stop it now because you're giving an advantage to one fuel over another. You're giving an advantage to oil.
I think I love you.
And so this is another place where I would say that a system like Georgia has is much more flexible, because you won't be upset if you give an advantage to oil. If you say, well, we're going to have natural gas backup for renewables, except when we have to have some oil on site, That's fine. And by the way, I looked at a couple of studies on the difference in price between RTO systems and vertically integrated systems. And they're always saying that the vertically integrated systems are always less expensive, but they're always saying that the RTOs are closing the gap. They've had 25 years to close the gap and become cheaper. If this kind of market system saves consumers money, it's had a long time to prove it, and it hasn't.
Casey, this is golden. This is going into the Hall of Fame of Energy Matters.
For our listeners at home who obviously on the radio cannot see Tim, he has a huge grin on his face right now and has been nodding along vigorously to Meredith speaking about these different market designs.
Meredith, I can't tell you how many times I go to a conference, NARUC, I'm from the South, you know, they're laughing at my accent, they're mocking this and that about our state, but you know what? We have a system that delivers. We have the reliability. We're the only state building new nuclear, you know, in America. We're going to do this, and we get mocked for that too. But Meredith, reliability and autonomy is so important to us, and all of this RTO stuff, I mean, to me, it subverts the authority of constitutional officers like myself. So I love the system that we have. Well, thank you for being on our show today. You've been a fantastic guest. Casey, I just am floored. And just another affirmation that's going to help me be able to sleep at night. Thanks, Casey, for being on. Meredith, thank you. Folks, you can catch any of our back episodes at WGAUradio.com or anywhere you get your podcast. Just search for Energy Matters with Commissioner Eccles. You've been listening to Energy Matters. Have a great day, everyone.
The electric car revolution is coming, and the choices are growing. GEM cars are everywhere. You've seen these low-speed electric vehicles on college campuses, downtown Atlanta streets, and resort islands like St. Simons and Jekyll. GEM cars are street legal, equipped with seatbelts, headlights, and a tag, and can operate on roads with speed limits of 35 miles per hour or less. If you want to know more about these electric cars and trucks, six-passenger shuttles, mobile repair service, or full vehicle wraps, go to GEMCarService.com. That's GEMCarService.com.
Creative Solar USA is a Georgia-based turnkey installer of innovative solar panel systems. With their NABCEP certified installers, they ensure you receive the highest quality solar energy system in the industry. They're proud to work with you before, during, and after the install, blending customer demand, system capability, and expertise to provide the best service possible. Contact them today at 770-485-7438 or creativesolarusa.com.